That's great. So yes, welcome to Rural Spot. So Rural Spot is one of many activities that we'll be doing over the life of this amazing new project called Culturality. Those of you who have agreed to come along have already been sent lots of information and links to our website. So hopefully you've got a flavour of what it is. And we'll do a brief introduction to sort of set the scene today. But just to say that this is just the beginning of a series of events and activities over the next 4 years. Oh, I've gone the wrong way again. There we go. Cool. So, I'm Carol Sinclair. I'm going to sort of guide us through today's activities. And I am one of three people from an organisation called Applied Arts Scotland. Most of you, all of you, I think, already know Nettie. And we also have Claire. And we're delighted to be partners in this Culturality project. We're an organisation, a charity, and a membership organisation that represents the sort of creative and business development opportunities for the craft sector in Scotland. We work across Scotland. And we're in this project very much with the voice of makers as makers ourselves. I make ceramics, Claire works with wood and metal, and Nettie's the textile guru. So we're delighted to be the hosts of this very first event. And I suppose that leads into that question of actually what is culturality? And I'm hoping that you will have had a sense of what it's about. But I think just to give you a brief kind of overview, it's a four-year research project. So this is, we're now in month six, and we've got a lot of time ahead of us to do our activities. And we are a consortium of 13 partner organisations across 9 countries. And I tested myself this morning to remember the countries. It is Norway, Sweden, Scotland, Portugal, Spain, Italy, Estonia, and then I get lost. Slovenia and Romania. Oh, see, I had it. So, those 9 countries. And we're really lucky to have representatives from most of those organisations with us today, the partners or the consortium, as we're known. And what will culturality do? So really, our remit is to research, to then share and champion craft practices. Craft sits absolutely at the heart of the project, but it's also looking at how craft works with other types of creativity and in a broader cultural landscape. But craft sits firmly at the heart of what we're doing. And then looking at really good examples of sustainable cultural tourism. So we had to come here. This is a place that knows all about cultural tourism and in remote and rural areas. So that's the very simple kind of explanation of what we're about. And actually, just to set a little bit more of that scene, I'd really like to welcome Anna, who is the leader of our project consortium, just to do a brief sort of introduction. A hello and maybe a welcome.
Thank you.
Great. So, you're not doing slides. Just talking.
Just talking. Well, good morning, everyone. First of all, I need to introduce myself. My name is Ana Maria Fernandez, and I am the main researcher and coordinator of this European project. Called Culturality, that in English doesn't mean anything, but it's an acronym of a long title in this unique project. This project was selected by the European Commission through a committee of experts on the topic fostering socioeconomic development and job creation in rural and remote areas through cultural tourism. In culturality, we identify craftsmanship and intangible cultural heritage as potential drivers for developing a sustainable, non-seasonal tourism that respects the environment with immense potential to retain the population and preserve the wealth and uniqueness of the especially fragile cultural heritage. We have formed a multidisciplinary group, academic team, composed by historians, art historians, computer scientists, ethnographers, designers, anthropologists, specialists in artificial intelligence. Additionally, we have chosen to include that is not very common in that kind of horizon projects, rural communities and artisans associations. We are 13 partners from the European continent, complementing each other with our academic and professional profiles. The Horizon project is the most competitive and prestigious research program within the European Union. The success rate for applicants is less than 15%, so the demands for results are very high and rigorous. Some of you ask maybe, why would a group of researchers from the University of Oviedo in Spain, in a peripheral, mountainous, and little known region of the country, commit to making this proposal, this successful proposal, working for months and involving European partners, some of them we didn't even know personally? Elementary. Dear Watson, as Sir Conan Doyle said, because we believe in what we proposed. Many of the group members grew up in rural areas, and we understand what is happening in this post-industrial society. We see how the countryside and the village life are dying. We are aware that the know-how of traditional vision is disappearing, and with it a part of our culture and our identity. The simple shape of a spoon is a cultural matter because it reveals the relationship between the material and the natural environment, with food traditions and the blending of influence of other cultures. For us, who are mostly art historians, a textile product or a ceramic piece from a rural environment acts as a material evidence of social history, the history of the common people, which was made invisible by political history for centuries, with the same strength as a cathedral or a sculpture. Our commitment to this project is unwearable, and we are determined to see it through to its successful completion. The scientific challenges we face are not few. We will enter into debates about authenticity of craftsmanship, the coexistence with new artisans, the balance between tourism and sustainability, and the difficult task of analyzing intangible knowledge and in turning into a touristic resource. Like those witches and devilish dances of Tan or Santer described in one of the most famous poems of the Scottish Robert Burns. We will have to talk to the artisans understand their concerns and professional situations, converse with rural communities, and grasp their frustrations and expectations. We believe we cannot disappoint them. I might be optimistic about the results. Still, as a child, I admired the character of Peter Pan from Dane Kiley, and his desire to find the Never Never Land, filled with big dreams and grand ambitions. But beyond being enthusiastic, I have my feet on the ground, and I aspire to turn those dreams into realities. I speak on behalf of all the partners when I say that we are all happy to be in Scotland, in this beauty and unique landscape and place. We are impressed of the beauty of the this paradise, natural paradise, the cultural richness of the region. Well, I want also to thank your hospitality, the tough work made by our friends, Scottish friends, to prepare this meeting. And also, I want to express my gratitude to the stakeholders to be here this day, because you are very busy. And well, we appreciate so much your collaboration. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Hannah. I think that expressed the excitement that we're all feeling in the consortium to have a chance to be together and work together. We've been here for this last 2 days, two and a half days, having a chance to travel and see what's around us. So it's a great opportunity to pick up on what we've observed and have conversations about how we might all be working together going forward. So thank you, Anna. And I suppose that takes me to just the next bit of my introduction, which is really to sort of build on that question of why should you get involved? What's in it for you? What's interesting? What's useful? And so I just wanted to briefly summarise some of the aspects of the project that we hope will be of interest. You're at our very first event, and we'll be doing a series of these over the next 4 years. But you're in at the beginning, so you have an even bigger say in just that direction of travel. Before we finish today, we'll be asking you what you think, out of all of the things that is possible, what would be useful for you? And that's really important to us. We're not coming telling you how we think things should be done by any stretch. We're very much coming here to learn and listen and think, how can we work together? So there is an opportunity beyond today. Hopefully we'll see each other in many other events, and some of those will be in person and some of those will be online for very practical reasons of having conversations internationally. And so being part of an international network of people who have the same philosophies, that maybe have slightly different ideas that we can exchange, but who are interested in this idea of the value and importance of craft and culture to drive our economic needs. We will be creating together a database, an international database of contacts that will be very useful, I think, to all of us. And actually, one of the big sort of outputs of the project is something you'll hear more about today. Our colleagues at St Andrews University are here with this fascinating set of equipment over here, and they are leading on the development of a virtual museum which will capture and present craftspeople, the things they make, the materials they use, the skills they have. And so there's a very exciting opportunity for the craftspeople across our territories to be part of that amazing archive. And we will be together exchanging and gathering examples of good practice so that we can all share those and learn from them and develop them and innovate with them. But I think, as Anna already pointed out, there's an enormous variety of expertise in the culturality team. I have to say, as a craftsperson, I'm so excited that this expertise is being applied to, you know, the subject I love, and we can learn together and have deeper understanding of how we can work successfully to promote creativity, culture, and craft. And I say craft with a very big, you know, emphasis, because it's so important. And I think we're in a place that understands that completely. So, let me then tell you what we're up to today. So what we're going to do is really tap into lots of the local activities and expertise and hear from three speakers. We've asked them to sort of chat for about half an hour so that we can learn about their activities, and then we will follow each of those presentations with a roundtable discussion, which is why we've sort of wanted to position you in particular ways, so that we've got a mix of disciplines and knowledge at each table. We're really rather deliberately not giving people an opportunity to ask questions of the speakers. I think Mark said, "What? What? Can't answer questions?" We're kind of doing that deliberately, because then we can all continue to meet up and speak to each other. But we are going to ask you at the table to start thinking about your own questions and your own ideas. And that's why you've got a nice big placemat, we're calling it, in front of you that we're going to get you to write on, so that we can capture those thoughts. We'll then have lunch, very important. We've discovered that food is probably the driver that we all have to, you know, be particularly aware of. So we'll have lunch together. And then after lunch, we'll hear a bit more from St. Andrews about just the practicalities of what they're doing. We've invited people to bring objects to be scanned, and we'll have some activity of that happening throughout the day. And then by the end of today, we want to just pull together a conversation around really what are the priorities, what are the things that you feel culturality could offer, help, provide. We need to hear where you think this will be useful to you. So, does that make sense so far? Okay. So, I think without further ado, really, we should... I'm going backwards again. You know the rules already. Am I right that we're colour coding? So if we can ask you, the colour that's on your lanyard is the colour of pen that we would like you to write in when you write your notes, so that we can identify really clearly if you are a maker, if you are a consortium member, or if you are a stakeholder. And that allows us at a very quick glance to sort of group some of this data. So does that make sense? Nettie's in control of the pens, so we'll just make sure. But we've put a little guide on each of the tables so that you can remember what colour you have to write in. This is the without further ado. So I'm absolutely delighted. Lorna and I have met on several occasions already, but mostly virtually in recent years, so it's lovely to sort of see you in person. And I think, you know, Harris Tweed, it's quite a big story, isn't it? So I'm going to hand over. Thank you so much.
Which one is it, Carol?
Oh, that's the bottom one to go forward.
Right here. Thank you. Key glasses. All right. Good morning, and thank you for that introduction. It's a real pleasure. Can you hear me? I'm prone to wonder about. It's a real pleasure to be asked to join your conference today. I have met Carol many times, and I've worked with Nettie for a long time, and Nettie's involved in many projects over these years, and she always gives Harris Tweed a platform, and I'm very grateful for that, Nettie. It's really important to help us get our story out. You're all very welcome, of course, but to those of you for whom this is not your island home, welcome to our island home. It's a really special place. It is the home of Harris Tweed, and I hope you leave loving it as much as we all do. The weather's always like this in October. It's not. It's clearly not. Hey, what have I done here?
Yes, it's the bottom arrow.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That one there.
Yeah. Okay.
Great.
Time does not allow today at all for us to do full justice to the full and fascinating timeline of the Harris Tweed industry. Instead, what we'll do is just pit stop through some of the highs and lows and twists and turns of the fascinating backstory of this industry. We'll touch on the unique structure it has left us with, some of the opportunities and challenges we're faced with today. And we'll also touch on briefly the tourism contribution this industry makes to our island economy and infrastructure. Nettie also asked me when we were emailing back and forth about this presentation, she posed the question, what came first, Harris Tweed or tourism? And I, for this one, I'm going to say textiles trumped tourism. The earliest surviving textile in Great Britain is known as the Cheshire Thing, and it's catalogued in the National Museum as such. It's a piece of felt with attached cords and braids. It dates to the Iron Age, the Bronze Age, I beg your pardon, and it's about 3,000 years old. It was found at the bottom of a peat bank in the village of Chester in Point. Who knew, eh? And it was made of horsehair and cattle hair with some wool and was likely to have been a mask rather than clothes or garments. So it maybe explains why the Ruachs, the people from Point, think they're so much more stylish than the rest of us. Eh? Any Ruachs in the room? Any Point people in the room? No? Good. Good. Good, good. Oh, okay. Okay. So fast forward with me, if you will, a mere few thousand years to pre-industrial revolution in the 18th century. Times are hard. The kelp industry is on the decline. And weaving as a means of providing warmth and protective clothing for their families was on the rise on the islands. The flying shuttle was introduced to the textile industry, making weaving faster and more efficient. And, we can imagine times were tough in the islands at that time. In 1836... Alexander Dunmore, the 6th Earl of Dunmore, inherited the North Harris estate, and he and his wife, Catherine Herbert, began to spend increasing amounts of time here on the island. And they employed staff, estate staff, gamekeepers, gillies, and such like. He's recorded as being well-liked. She is recorded as being well-liked. He, distant and unrelatable in the records. But weaving is by now becoming commonplace and has been traded locally. By 1844, potato blight has hit hard and there's grim hardship in Harris. And Catherine Dunmore has begun to befriend locals and she wants to help them out. The Countess arranged for two local young women, Marion and Christina MacLeod, from the village of Strond in Harris, to go off to Paisley, which by this point had a well-established textile sector, the Paisley pattern. She arranged for them to go to Paisley to learn the craft of weaving and bring it back and cascade their new knowledge to their fellow islanders in Harris. Paisley, that journey we shouldn't underestimate. It's unlikely these women would ever have been off-island. English certainly wouldn't have been their native tongue. And whilst you and I can fly to Glasgow for the price of an arm and leg today, that was an enormous undertaking at that time. Of course, the Herring girls would have done a similar job back and forth from the east coast of Scotland at about the same time, so it wasn't unheard of. So Christina and Marion became known as the Paisley sisters, and there is still to this day a small, characteristically modest cairn on their family croft, noting that that is the origins of the Harris Tweed industry. The Countess herself was sadly widowed in 1845 when her husband died very suddenly, aged only 41. She was left with four small children. And just prior to his death, the Earl had placed an order for Murray Tartan for estate staff. So when Lady Dunmore was travelling back and forth from London, she recognised that this was a means of some income for the Harris people she had befriended. And so she would take examples of the woven cloth back and forth from London with her and sell it to her wealthy friends and associates in London. And that really, friends, is how the Harris Food story began. Into the 1900s now, and this industry had spread its wings from Harris into Lewis. In 1909, the Harris Food Association was formed, and in 1910, the Orb certification mark was granted. And I'm really struck by, I'm often struck by the vision and foresight of these four or five men in Harris in 1909, in hard times, who had the foresight to register with the then Board of Trade a trademark for what they saw was happening in their fledgling industry. To this day, the Harris Food Orb trademark, certification mark, is the oldest continuously used trademark in British history. Bass beer is number one on the register, but they ceased trading during both wars, and we didn't. So the Harris Food Orb mark is the UK's oldest continuously used trademark. And very sadly, and it's a question we're often asked, very sadly, all the artwork and the documentation pertaining to the registration was lost in the bombing. The World War I bombings in London. And so we're often asked, you know, where did the orb come from? And we don't really know. We imagine the orb relates to the royal origins of the Dunmore family. The Maltese cross may be of religious symbolism. In some definitions, a Maltese cross is also a symbol of strength and durability. Much like the cloth itself. The 13 dots are said to represent, at that time, the 13 inhabited islands of the Outer Hebrides. A few words on Mr. Henry Lyons. Mr. Lyons was a Savile Row tailor who, in 1906, was sued by the Board of Trade for the crime of passing off cloth made in mills in Huddersfield, in the north of England, as Harris Tweed. Records show the magistrate of his time took a very dim view and deemed it a clear case of fraud, and Mr. Lyons was sentenced to 2 months' imprisonment. In summarising, the magistrate declared, "A considerable trade is now done in the cloth. The price of Harris Tweed is high, and it is difficult to get enough of it. The matter affected very seriously the trade carried out by the crofters of the outer lying islands of Scotland. One of these islands is named Harris, from which the Tweed takes its name. The Daily Mail of its day reported, the defendant, Mr. Lyons, fell down in a fit at the sentence." And of course, if it was in the Daily Mail, it must be right. But in all honesty, whilst the language is different, in all the cases, I've done this job for 16 odd years, in all the cases we've taken to court, the ruling by the judge or sheriff is almost exactly the same, whilst the language is modernised a little bit. We don't go to court unless we know we're going to win, and the same sentiment stands today, that we must protect this industry at all costs. Into the 20th century, we brazen Ljósvík, people from Lewis, have begun to authenticate tweed as woven in Lewis as Harris Tweed. The wooden loom is slowly being superseded with the cast iron workhorse that is the Hattersley single width loom. And in 1934, there was a pivotal legal ruling stating that mill spun yarn could be used in the industry, replacing the spinning frame that would have been used up until that point. In 1935, production exceeded 1 million metres for the first time, and the trademark was registered in America. The late 1950s were, though, very difficult times for the industry, and there were bitter, bitter wrangles on island here between the producers and the Harris Tweed Association, the organisation that predates the one I work for, the Harris Tweed Authority. This ended up in court in what was at the time, until the Lockerbie case, the longest ever civil case in Scottish legal history. However, the Lord Hunter ruled in favour of the Harris Tweed Association and confirmed that all all processes relating to the Harris tweed industry must happen here on the island. No element of its manufacture can happen off island. And this was a huge victory for the industry and arguably what forever anchored it here in these shores. I just show this picture. I show this picture sometimes when the board, when there's board members, HTA board members in the room, just to show the dress code has deteriorated dreadfully over the years. There's no three-piece suits rocking up anymore. But this was a board picture from 1942. The gentleman second to the left there is John Murdo Morrison of Harris Hotels' grandfather, if any of you know John Murdo. Let's just go on to the next one. In 1966, the Harris tweed production peaked at 7.6 million yards of cloth leaving these island shores. And again, despite this high, the industry then went into a really difficult period through the 70s. There was very significant decline at this time. And there was some recognition, for the first time, I think, that the industry must evolve at this time. And this is where there's the first mention of introducing a double-width loom. This proposal was squarely rejected by the weaving population on the island at the time. A second boom came along in the mid-1980s and was largely credited to sales in North America and Canada. And this was also credited to a really maverick Free Church minister of his time, the Reverend Murdoch McRae, going out there and lobbying for some concessions around duty. So the early 1990s were certainly in our contemporary era an absolutely pivotal mark in how we went forward. A Harris tweed working group was formed, £10 million of EU funding was secured, and the double width loom was introduced. I just want to just show you a Hattersley loom. This is the workhorse that held up the industry through these peak years in the 60s. It is a cast iron, beautiful piece of engineering. It weaves cloth at 75 centimetres wide and is a shuttlebox operation. And in the early 1990s, it moved to a double-width loom that weaves at 150 wide. It's a rapier operation. There's still about 150 of those in operation throughout the island at the moment. So 1993, in the years leading up to 1993, the Harris Tweed Act achieved Royal Assent, and it seems outrageous to gloss over that in one quick slide. It was an enormous milestone for the industry. But it did forever, in law, secure the definition of Harris Tweed. It also created the Harris Tweed Authority, previously the Harris Tweed Association. Now the Harris Tweed Authority is a statutory body in law, tasked with promoting, protecting, and ensuring this industry is around in the future. And that is what we do. It was not at all, I'm told, a smooth passage through the statute books, where we're assured that if we were to try today to get a piece of legislation like the Harris Tweed Act, it would have little or no chance. And it's survived various reviews, the Kalman Commission, the Smith Commission, and other looks at legislation that have happened in the UK and in Scotland. But our Act, thankfully, sits quietly in Westminster and does its thing down there. That the previous slide was the definition and of Harris Tweed as it stands today, and I don't think is likely to change, and what the role of the Harris Tweed Authority is. It has left us with a really unusual and anomalous structure. It is a co-dependent industry. For any piece of Harris Tweed to leave these shores, it needs weavers, it needs production mills, and it needs ourselves, the Harris Tweed Authority. Just very, very briefly to say the top three lines. The wool arrives on island already scoured, washed and scoured. We buy all our wool from British Wool. In Bradford, it is the one source of buying wool in the UK. And the top three lines through to beaming all happen at the production mill, where we have three commercially competitive production mills all making Harris Tweed yarn. That yarn is then passed out to an army of home-based weavers around the villages of Lewis and Haddis. There are some in Stornoway, of course, but not many. Is that me? Is it something I'm doing? I don't know. Okay. So the yarn is passed out to the weavers to weave at their own homes and then collected again by the mill, taken back to the mill for finishing, quality control, and then presented to us at the Haddis Tweed Authority for the authentication as genuine Haddis Tweed. Only when the Haddis Tweed Authority inspectors are satisfied that that cloth has been woven in accordance with the Act, that we've got paperwork to show its provenance and its journey, will they apply the Orb trademark. And then it is packaged and sent off all around the world. There are three production mills on the island, as I say, all slightly servicing slightly different segments of the market, but all making Haddis Tweed. In addition to the mills, there is a small number of independent producers, craftsmen and women weavers, who design, warp, beam and weave their own designs. They don't weave for the mills. And they sell direct to customers. There's a small number of them. It's a fragile section of the industry at the moment. They all, maybe with the exception of one, work on the Hattersley, but they're still there and they're still important. As I say, I'm still desperately searching that sail into Antarctica and Africa. I've not got the evidence yet of that one, but we're pretty much shipping globally. People say to me, why in the world do you show this graph? It's just a depressing graph, but I think it just tells a really important story. That's that peak in the middle in 1966 of 7.6 million yards, and then the decline we spoke about, a slight peak again in the mid-80s, and then you see decline. And you know, that's for a number of reasons, but not least that we wool, men putting their wool jacket on of a day is no longer, you know, what happens. It was through these peak years. We live in a world of performance fabrics where we maybe all wore our Gore-Tex jacket thinking it's going to rain, public transport, central heating. Wool has changed. And I think, you know, had the Haddis Tweed industry continued to only serve as the men's jacket-making company, that would have been the end for us, and we had to evolve, and we'll say a wee bit more about that. I think the other thing I want to say to this graph is I grew up here on the islands in the 80s, early 90s, and my parents presumably were optimistic for me and my career. They would have never encouraged me into the Haddis Tweed industry. It was an industry, I don't know if other young islanders would have felt the same, it was an industry that wasn't able to reciprocate with careers, reliable careers at that time. And just as the graph is beginning to turn at the end there, today's industry is, albeit in small numbers, it is an industry that is able to provide quality year-round employment with pay, reward, progression, all the things you and I look for in our career that, when I was growing up, it couldn't deliver. And I think that's a really important turning point for our industry. I just want to touch very briefly on 2009 as well. That was crisis point, just 450,000 metres of cloth produced, and the point of whether it was viable to continue or not. But thankfully, our industry paused and regrouped and reflected and agreed it was time to evolve. And I think, I don't think it's well known just how close it came to drawing a line under it in 2009. And I'm so glad that there was industry recognition that we will never again be a 7 million or even 5 million metre industry, but we agree to be a better 2 or 3 million metre, 1 or 2 million metre industry, and that's the mark and that's the benchmark we operate at even till today. Because of all these peaks and troughs, it's difficult to retain a workforce. Difficult to retain a workforce, and we've had to think about ways to train new weavers into the industry. This is Anna and her dad, Bonus, and by gum, they fight like cat and dog at the loom. It's his loom, and she's a trainee, and I don't know when that'll ever change, but it's how the skill is passed on most effectively from experience to the next generation. The role of the authority, we have a role to protect and promote and provide industry support. I'm not going to go into all the things we do. I'll make sure the presentation goes online for you. We hold an enviable portfolio of trademarks in 57 countries around the world. And we manage that portfolio, and we, I would say, punch above our weight in how we protect this industry out there in the world. The label has become a really interesting dynamic. There is almost as much equity in the label now as there is in the cloth. The Harris Reed label used to be worn quietly inside Dad's jacket. It is now worn out. It is a brand. It is no longer just a label of authenticity. It is a brand in its own right, and that requires managing and protecting as well. And we look after that. Just some examples of what we're up against. This is, forgive the dodgy blur, but I mean, I don't know if you agree, but they are all clearly takeoffs of the Harris Reed label, but not enforceable because they're subtly different. And in China, unless it's a straight takeoff, you can't fight it. And it's just a real challenge. So we're monitoring, I think I've got a slide, we're monitoring big online platforms in China, Japan, Korea, all over the world, every day. We're talking something in the region of 80 takedowns a day. This one is showing jackets, men's coats for $22, and it's purporting to be able to do 1,000 pieces. If that was genuine, we'd know about it. We'd know that about that order. That's clearly fake. $22 is not possible. So we've got pretty sophisticated. So I think what I'm trying to say is we've got this really old craft industry doing pretty sophisticated online monitoring, keywords, visuals, graphics, looking for fakes out there. We've done labels. We've done that. I think I'm going the wrong direction, am I? That's what I'm doing wrong. Do I need to say any more? Okay. The Harris Reed Authority was in a legal wrangle with Westwood for 23 years. When I came into post, we concluded that nobody was winning other than the lawyers. It's really difficult. It's the toothpaste is out of the tube with Westwood, but we manage it. There is in place a worldwide coexistence agreement. Vivian Westwood sadly passed away a couple of years ago. We thought it might sort of dissipate. It really hasn't, but we coexist and it works. But that is a real challenge for us in terms of brand awareness. Quick word on, is that Harris Tweed? It's got about a fiver's worth of Harris Tweed in its interior. It's a Jaguar Land Rover with a little bit of Harris Tweed as an option in its interior, and they thought it was okay to stick an orb on the truck. You know, it's clearly not. Jackets in TK Maxx 4 or 5 years ago. That's the extent of the Harris Tweed on the whole product, called a Harris Tweed jacket, full of labels, orbs on the hangers, orbs on the buttons, orbs everywhere. You know, would you do that with Apple Mark's logo or Coke's logo or, you know, no. And we're kind of showing our teeth to say you can't do it with ours either. And that's what we're busy at. Pair of jeans in the next catalogue, or the next website a couple of seasons ago. The exact same jeans without Harris Tweed, without 20 pence worth of Harris Tweed on the back pocket was £44. The ones with Harris Tweed in the back pocket were £49. So for tiny, you know, for a tiny bit of Harris Tweed on this product, they're taking a premium. What are we getting back as an industry? And that's part of our job to ensure that we're getting some return to our industry for takeoffs like that. I'm running right out of time. Just to say, you know, health and safety has somewhat caught up with the ability to open up Harris Tweed mills and weavers' premises to visitors to the island. By luck of the offices we use in Stornoway Town Hall, we have a beautiful story room. It has an old wooden loom in it, it has a Hatterley loom in it, and it has a double width loom in it, and some lovely other archive materials. It's open May to October. We've been finding our feet with it over the last few years, but feel we have hit it this year because We put a real live, living, breathing weaver in there. And that's what's been the thing. That's what's changed it, and it's been really busy. Yes, there are other things in the town, the cruise ships and other things, which we'll just touch on in a moment. But we have a really beautiful representation that's not authentic. Clearly, it's not in a weaver's home and in a weaver's shed, but it tells a story in about 30 to 35 minutes of the Haddistreet industry, and it's filling a space. I think we absolutely know we're a wet weather destination. We absolutely know we're, once you've checked the car in for the ferry, let's cross the road to the town hall. But I don't mind. You know, it's filling a gap and telling the story in a really kind of condensed way. We take visitors from all over the world, as you'd expect. And the sort of orangey lines are the days there were ships in port this season, and so we absolutely can quantify, Sally, that's having an impact, and we're filling a gap for them too, which we're thrilled about. We have a trail map on our website, so you know people don't spend their holiday in Stornoway; they're out and about in rural Lewis, and there is something to visit in every nook and cranny relating to Haddistreet. And we get great traffic through the trail map too. There is a downside, the Royal Mile. There is a danger of the tat market. That's a concern and a worry for us. We appreciate that not everybody has the funds or the ability to carry a jacket back with them on their travels. They may just want to take a little something, a key ring, to whoever's looking after the cat back home. But it's a conflict for us that we are somewhat in the tat market in the Scottish tourism retail offering, and it's something we have to watch and manage. Get Your Guide. Didn't know anything about it. The Gen Zer in the office introduced us to Get Your Guide. It's an online booking system for nice things to do when you're on holiday. It's been very, very successful for us. They take a whacking 30% of the booking fee, but it's worth it, we have found. Wrong way again, Lorna. So, just to conclude, the old dog had to learn new tricks. Dad's jacket wasn't going to hold us up into the next generation. So we have moved into beautiful accessories, working with, collaborating with brands, and recognising that you know it's an entry point to Haddistreet. However, we're not the taste police, and that's a frustration. These, my friends, are toilet roll holders, and much as we hate them, there's nothing we can do about them. They're in compliance with the brand rules. It's genuine tweed. It's genuine labels. We're not the taste police. Thankfully, women want a new coat every winter. Men are quite happy with one every 15 years or so. So women's wear has been a huge growth area for us. Interiors and soft furnishings being the biggest growth area for us. Nothing like a wee royal endorsement. Didn't know how to use an iron. Nothing like a wee celebrity endorsement either. That's our story room again. And I just, you know, it's not a plug at all. There's a beautiful book called From the Land, Comes the Cloth. It's a photographer based in Cumbria who has beautifully documented the relationship between this industry, the people, the cloth, and the landscape we live in. It's a beautiful book available in our offices for a mere £160. That's why I struggle to endorse it. But anyway, it's beautiful. So thanks for your time. As always, I've gone over.
Oh, Lorna, wow. That was so much information, and there's such a rich history and so many things to think about. And I know that people will have lots of questions for you, but they can't ask you because that's not the rules of today. So what we want to do now is just have a provocation to each of the tables to have a discussion. The facilitator in each table is just going to make sure that every voice gets heard. We want everybody to chip into the conversation because we've got so many bits of experience and perspectives, and we want to capture them all. So our facilitator, I'll help with the timing. If you can make sure that we've got maybe 15 minutes chat and everybody gets a chance to contribute. But what we'd also like you to do at the end of that is make some notes. Things that you would like us to be thinking about. We're going to take these bits of paper away from you at the end of today to inform our next steps and our research. So jot down your thoughts. Jot them down as you go, if you want to, if you've got a sudden moment of whoo or a question. But if you can make sure you're just putting those things down on paper for us in English, please. My Spanish is still nowhere. But the question we want you to consider, and it's a big question with many possible routes, is could the Harris Tweed model, and there are many layers to that model of protection, of marketing, of branding, but could that model that we've just heard about be adapted to other creative and cultural practices within your sphere of work? Yes? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
We know that you're coming from lots of different places, so it's trying to think maybe a bit laterally and what can you learn and what can we take forward? Yeah? Okay, everybody. 15 minutes. Off you go.